I'm Damien Searles, and I'm going to read a story from my new book, What We Were Doing and Where We Were Going. Before I do, I want to say a little about the book, and I'll start by reading its epigraph, which is from Henri Matisse, a novel by Louis Aragon. Why does the painter need a model if he's going to deviate from it? Matisse told me, mischievously, that if there were no model, one couldn't deviate from it. This seemed to me at the time a mere wisecrack. Then, as the years went by, the thing took its peculiar course within me. I began to love Matisse's very deviation from the model, the way he takes liberties with it. I understand him now, better than I understand myself. What you find out in the last story of my book is that all of the stories are rewritings or riffs or covers of stories from the past by Gide, Hawthorne, Nabokov, Yasushi Inoue, a Japanese writer, and Tommaso Landolfi, an Italian writer. All my stories are set in the present, but some take the plot, some use the same structure, some even plagiarize specific sentences from the other stories. The one I'm going to read today, A Guide to San Francisco, is modeled on Nabokov's story, A Guide to Berlin. And in that case, I took the structure, which is a five-part structure introduced with a little lead-in about the conversation that the two main characters are going to have. Now, you find all this out at the end of the book because you don't need to know it to enjoy the stories any more than you would need to know what a Matisse model actually looked like. The stories should stand on their own. So, as Aragon asks, why does a writer need a model if he's going to deviate from it? I decided to take this approach for my first book of stories and to own up to it. I think probably more people take it than own up to it. Because, as Aragon said, I understand these stories better than I understood myself. They gave me a kind of permission to write about what I wanted to write about, but didn't know I wanted to write about. So probably the best example of that is that I had a job in Silicon Valley during the dot-com boom that was quite cushy, but ultimately not very fulfilling. The last thing I wanted to do was write some kind of memoir-y story about my life there, but I knew Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Custom House, which is his own story about his own cushy but ultimately not very fulfilling job. And so instead of writing a memoir, I set out to rewrite the Hawthorne story. And the result was my story, The Cubicles, which was autobiographical but interesting for other reasons, like the friction between the flowery, leisurely, ironic 19th century style with all these long sentences, and then the fast-paced, present-day, glitzy Silicon Valley content. If I didn't have that as a model, I couldn't have deviated from it. It's probably also relevant that I'm a translator, and I have what I think of as a translator's imagination. Reading is what makes me creative. I like to take things in and then put them back out as the same but different and mine. One difference between the translation and these stories is that I translate books I love, but the five model stories for this book are not necessarily my favorite stories in the world. They're the ones that happen to take their peculiar course within me and get me going. So here's my story, A Guide to San Francisco. A Guide to San Francisco. This morning I took the bus to work in the outer Richmond, down the long, wide avenues out toward the sea, and now I'm waiting in a bar for my friend. It's a bar in the Mission with a fat, happy pig instead of a shingle hanging down from the night. My friend arrives, and I start to tell him about the gray sky, telephone wires, and other important matters. 1. The sky. Like stones at the seaside, a December sky like this afternoon's gets its beauty from wetness. Dull sandstone buildings regain their sandy glory, the glory of a sunlit beach, while the sky is the color the sea must be, still and gray under an afternoon sky. The buildings and the sky are in strange resonance, and between the two, the leaves on the trees drip with green. The air is too saturated to hold more color. It was late in the afternoon, late in the year. The rains that have lasted all week and threatened all day were late to arrive. Everything was late today, and at last it got through to me. I wondered what I was late for. Either the sky has been this color before, so gray it's blue against the rich yellow sandstone, and I've not noticed, or I've done something wrong with my life and never been granted this color until now. The wind picked up as I hurried down the street, shoulders hunched over, fists in my pockets. 2. The cables. On the bus to or from work, my eyes are drawn to the geography above the city. Cables, phone wires, streetcar lines, rows of poles like freeways and nodes like traffic jams where 30 or 40 or even 50 lines snarl into a single tangle. I want a map, in a different color, maybe an overlay or transparency on the street map. Guanajuato, a city roughly halfway from Guadalajara to Mexico City, in a long ravine, spilling its color up either side, has maps like that. A network of tunnels runs under the whole city, mostly for cars, but also for people. As you walk around town, you come across passageways into the cliffs, or stairwells like those leading down into subway stations. The maps of Guanajuato you get from the tourist office are printed in green and white, green for below ground, like a prophecy of spring. This makes me imagine a man who spends his days in the other parallel city, a dozen feet below, not above, the streets of San Francisco, in the subway tunnels, among the gas mains, phone cables again, foundations, and their natural counterparts, water tables, strata, roots. In a room you can reach only through his office in the Department of Public Works, stands this man's private work, a three-dimensional model of the underground, a grid of clear plastic rods, a half cube 15 or 20 feet square and about 8 feet high, with colored wires that represent all the different burrowings. The model is not to scale, just as relief maps have to exaggerate a thousandfold, a globe to scale would feel smooth as marble, Everest and the Marianas Trench and all. The horizontal overpowers the vertical, in this as in all things. The colored filaments snaking through the clear grid would have to be microscopically thin for a scale model of even the downtown district to fit in his office. But aside from that, the model is perfect as he can make it. It is almost impossible for anyone except him and me to recognize in these fragile, widely spaced lines the thick, earthy claustrophobia of artificially lit tunnels that one may have seen or traveled through or built. But he translates in the opposite direction. Whenever he is below ground, he not only thinks, but sees, and as it were dreams, in the language of his map. I feel that this is the only sense of art, to create an inner universe we prefer to the other one. If I could write enough and make it true enough, then perhaps I could have what I write before my eyes always. After looking at enough Van Goghs, you go out into the world, and everything seems like a Van Gogh. And what else is paradise? 3. Pentimento. The first time I visited San Francisco as a high school student, I took the ferry over glittering waters to the western edge of the city, walked around downtown, and then back toward Coit Tower to the south, which I climbed at the end of the day in a cold summer wind. I still remember the bright colors of the ferry building, the cable car terminus at the bottom of the hill, metal rails in the brick streets, white flags flapping, the grassy field to one side. Except the ferry arrives at the east shore of San Francisco. Coit Tower rises up to the north, and I've never again found the green field at the base of the hill, the street-side benches I sat on, the record store I stopped into. I also remember climbing a steep San Francisco hill and reaching a pier, so I know how trustworthy these memories must be. The sea is found at sea level. I'm afraid this fact of everyday experience outweighs memory. But I need only recall my first San Francisco, and it overpowers my experience, even when I'm on the real streets, at the real Coit Tower, or the ferry building. 4. Millefleur. Westward, the course of the 31 bus takes its way, parallel to Golden Gate Park, a few blocks to the south. The streets are wide in the Richmond, and all but empty, which makes this neighborhood feel like the West, tumbleweeds and a stagecoach, a warm wind blowing through town with an eerie whistle. Endless two- or three-story wooden houses, chipper pinks or yellows, often faded to gray or white, follow after each other with that purely American disregard of space. There's no pressure to build high or close, no hurry to get to the grocery store or acupuncture center at the end of the block. The architects or city planners, in a purely American stupor, just kept on going. What businesses there are out here are in residential buildings too, in the area's attempt to make this depressing street livable. Still, I prefer the 31 bus on Balboa to the 5 along the park, because this way, if I sit on the left, a gap between the buildings opens up every block, and a forest fills it, wild with mystery. One day in the 1950s, a student of Nabokov's came into his office and asked for advice on becoming a writer. Lolita had not yet let this distant, bossy Russian professor retire to the Montreux he deserved. Nabokov swiveled in his wooden desk chair, or so I imagine it, and pointed to the tree outside the window. What kind of tree it was has not come down to posterity. The professor's imperious question, "Can you tell me what kind of tree that is?" The student looks politely for appearance's sake before answering no. "Then you'll never be a writer." I don't know the kinds of tree in Golden Gate Park. For me, they're simply lush and dark at the bottom and plunge up at the top toward the heights of San Francisco. But I have to admit, I've never been as moved by the realists or the world-creating fabulists as I am by the pattern makers. Burgundian tapestry or complicated wallpaper fills the space that's there with treeness, and in the gaps between the buildings on Balboa lie textures of green that set me dreaming. I never walk down Balboa or Cabrillo all the way to the ocean, to the surf shop with its surf shop smell, but it's important to know you can. 5. The bar. "Sounds like a good day," my friend says, a literary type. Like San Francisco, he has two personas, rugged outdoorsy and stylish nerdy. Tonight, he's wearing his thick plastic glasses and a button-down short-sleeve shirt, foregoing Sierra Nevadas to drink intellectual Belgian beers, whose names he pronounces correctly. The glass doors in front are open. The first third of indoors might as well be outdoors. Our table sits right on the fault line. Behind my friend is the long, low bar with no bar stools, where you order but do not stand. There are enough cafe-style tables for everyone, especially on a warm night like tonight. I try again to describe the despair of the December sky, the disorientation around Coit Tower, and my non-existent dream coast at the top of a hill. "That reminds me of Guanajuato," he says. "I've never been." "An old silver town, very rich under the Spanish, so there's incredible colonial architecture there now. Basilicas, courtyards, tiles, high ceilings. But low mirrors," he says. "I had to bend down to see my face in every mirror in Mexico." Diego Rivera was born in Guanajuato, and there's a small museum in the house where he was born. The day I visited turned out to be his birthday. The other reigning spirit is Don Quixote. He lives in the Quixote Iconography Museum, where every painting, drawing, sculpture, plate, porcelain egg, macrame wall hanging shows Quixote, or Sancho Panza, or Dulcinea, or windmills, or the burning of the books. A strange pair, Rivera and Quixote. The muralist makes worlds, and the sad knight gets lost in them. Behind my back is Mexican San Francisco. Stray dogs, middle-aged couples taking their paseo, a mariachi trio wandering with their instruments between the Mexican restaurants and the white bars. My friend tells me to look. Across the street, a revival meeting has started up, in Spanish, complete with singing and a full band. I get up to use the bathroom, but it's out of order. Instead, I have to follow a long, narrow corridor off to the side, behind and parallel to the bar. It ends in a turn and a door, open onto the night at this end, too. Outside, the ambient light of the city is dim, but the way is too narrow to get lost in. Down a short flight of wobbly wooden stairs, along a tiny fenced walkway snaking through the dead space behind all the buildings on the block, and finally up a short flight of rickety stairs to a shed, with a thin sickle moon carved out of the door, and nothing inside but a toilet and a metal hook on the door and an eye on the door frame. I pull a long chain to flush from a tank above my head. When I get back to the table, my friend starts to tell me about the book he's working on, set in Silicon Valley, and the biotech complexes unsafely springing up on the landfill downtown where public housing was supposed to go. His descriptions remind me of everything I hate about living here. Too expensive, too divisive, too new. "I need to get out of the city," I say. "How can you want to leave San Francisco? People come to San Francisco. They don't leave. I barely pay attention to this conversation, the same one I have with all my friends these days. I'm looking over my friend's shoulder. From where I sit, I can see people reach the locked bathroom door, turn down the hall, and come back several minutes later with a bright expression on their faces, breath quick, eyes adjusted to the dim outdoor light. They've had an unexpected adventure, groping their way in the dark, climbing up and down stairs in the night.